And now, the best of health and fitness, the show that covers the health and fitness topics that matter most. Here's your host, Shani Rubin.
Welcome, listeners, to the best of health and fitness. I am your host, Shani Rubin, and we have an amazing show this morning. Joining me today is Dr. Donald Kreef, who is a recognized board-certified neurosurgeon. He performs both complex cranial and spinal surgery. He has special interest in computer-assisted resection of brain tumors and the management of traumatic injuries to the brain and spine. This is really fascinating stuff. Let me give a warm welcome to Dr. Kreef. Good morning, doctor. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Okay, let's start out first by letting the listeners know a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live out in Long Island, in Merrick. I am a neurosurgeon practicing in a very large group, probably one of the biggest private practice neurosurgery groups in the country, called Neurological Surgery PC. I am one of 16 partners. We have multiple offices, and generally our practice is sort of like subdivided into several different districts. There's a Nassau group, a Western Suffolk group, and an Eastern Suffolk group, and we all sort of coexist together. We all cover different hospitals and all do sort of different procedures.
Okay. Now, you specialize in the diagnosis of surgical treatment of disorders of the central and the peripheral nervous system, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, most people don't really understand the difference between like a neurosurgeon and a neurologist. That's sort of an important distinction. Neurologists tend to deal with diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, stroke, okay, multiple sclerosis, you know, things that are, you know, treatable but not necessarily surgical problems. Neurosurgeons tend to deal with situations where they're, you know, surgically treated lesions of the nervous system. So we deal with issues related to the brain, related to the spine, and also related to certain peripheral nerves like, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome and things like that. But the general neurosurgeons in the community, for the most part, most of the guys do spine surgery. That's sort of like the bread and butter of what the community guys do. Now, when we talk about community versus academic, that's mm-hmm. another distinction. Like the academic centers are usually places, you know, with residency programs, and they have different sort of subspecialty guys that do different things. They're also, you know, they have research responsibilities, teaching responsibilities. The private practice guys don't really have that. So we really just are clinical, take care of patients. You know, we see patients like any other doctor would. They come to the office with a, you know, they're referred in by different people, either a neurologist, a general practitioner, family medicine person, or even sometimes just self-referred guys, or even a lot of the pain management guys. They'll come in with, you know, usually a specific problem, imaging studies, generally speaking, an MRI scan, and then we'll obviously interview them, examine them physical exam-wise, discuss their issues, and then make a determination if indeed it's a surgical problem versus a non-surgical problem.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? Let's talk a little bit about the brain tumors, because a lot of people have them. What causes them?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think anybody knows exactly what causes them.
Okay.
For the most part, brain tumors, first of all, let's talk about that. There are different types of brain tumors. There are, you know, major.
There's a primary, right, and the secondary?
Right. Well, there's even more than that. Like, we could divide it into benign tumors and malignant tumors. So
okay.
The benign tumors, generally speaking, are sometimes they're surgical, sometimes they're not. I mean, there are times where we'll get called in, you know, for an emergency, someone gets in a car accident, and they'll find like a little benign tumor that's probably been there for a long, long time. That's not necessarily a surgical issue. The patients that require surgery are the ones that are potentially causing problems in the brain. Like, they come to medical attention because of symptoms that they cause. And obviously the ones that are malignant, because if they grow, and which they will, you know, obviously do,
right,
they'll grow, and without treatment, you know, people die from these things.
Sure.
Now, so the benign tumors and the malignant tumors are very different. The benign tumors are generally in the class of a meningioma or a tumor that sort of grows from the covering over the brain and pushes the brain in. There are different types of cysts that can occur in the brain that are not necessarily cancer or tumors, but they cause mass effect and are potentially issues that way. Now, the malignant tumors are the ones that sort of, you know, most people know somebody or know somebody that their family member or somebody had a malignant brain tumor
okay. And
wound up dying from that. And those are the ones that are like most commonly the primary tumors. Now, as we said, there are benign tumors and malignant tumors. The malignant tumors are generally divided into primary tumors, which are tumors that grow from the brain itself. And then you have secondary tumors or metastatic tumors that are also very common, and they usually are tumors that spread from another part of the body. Like, say, somebody is a smoker, they get lung cancer, and because of the disease and how rampant it can be,
sure.
It spreads to the brain and potentially causes neurologic dysfunction, and those are secondary tumors. So a primary tumor is a tumor that grows from the brain, and a secondary tumor is a tumor that goes to the brain from another part of the body, either, you know, breast cancer, lung cancer, sometimes colon, sometimes, you know, urinary tract cancers. But for the most part, brain tumors are, you know, really scary things. And depending on exactly what location they are in the brain, what the diagnosis is, it could be vastly different. I mean, people, you know, there are people that come into the emergency room with these small benign tumors that
right.
we don't even treat. I mean, we just follow them, you know, long term, and we decide, you know, are they surgical or are they not? So not every brain tumor, you know, is a disaster.
Require surgery, yeah.
Right. And it's also, you know, like some of them are basically incidental findings that don't even require any kind of treatment. But, you know, many of them do, and certainly, you know, it's a major scary nightmare for a family member to hear that, you know, somebody in their family has a brain tumor.
Sure. Well, let me ask you this. Back to the primary brain tumors, doctor. Now, you've mentioned there's no cause of getting a primary brain tumor. It just happens. I mean, are there risk factors? Does it depend on somebody's age or radiation or something that they're exposed to?
Sometimes radiation can be a cause, but for the most part, I think that they're generally finding that most of these things are going to wind up being, you know, somehow genetically related. Like probably most cancers are going to be found to be genetically related. Now, the reality is that, you know, yes, there are causes, but for the most part, we don't really know what the causes are. I mean, like the standard patient that we have, or, you know, a very common scenario will be a patient that has either, you know, in order for a brain tumor to become known, there has to be a, you know, either we find it by accident, like I said, you know, which is less likely. But the most common thing is that patients have symptoms. And the symptoms of a brain tumor are the following. You know, sometimes people can have headaches. You would imagine that, you know, the skull is a closed system. So,
okay.
you know, inside your skull, there's room for the brain, for some normal spinal fluid that's in there, and also the blood vessels.
And then when it swells, it causes the headache. Is that it?
Exactly. So, if there's something growing in the brain that's not supposed to be there, eventually it causes pressure and it causes significant headache. There are other kinds of scenarios where, you know, headache is a common cause, but there's also people that don't have any headaches. There are people that basically one day their you know, spouse or, you know, child or somebody will notice, hey, this is a little, like, why are you speaking like that? Like, what's wrong with your speech? And they won't even they may not even realize it, or they're acting a little strange, or all of a sudden, you know, they realize that it's difficult for them to write, or it's difficult for them to pick up things with one hand versus the other hand. And those are what we call focal neurologic symptoms, where the tumor is in a location where it's basically either invading into or pushing on a part of the brain that causes a specific problem. So if you have, like, you know, the brain has very specific areas that do certain things. So if you have a brain tumor that's next to an area that controls the function of your hand, you could, you know, and this thing grows into that, all of a sudden you have hand weakness. The other way things present is they present with a seizure. That's sort of a common thing that we see as well. Some, you know, say you have a, you know, a 50-year-old person that has never had a seizure before.
And then all of a sudden they're getting seizures.
Seizure, you know, seizure is basically abnormal electrical activity in the brain. So if you have somebody that has a first-time seizure with no apparent cause, you know, one of the first things that should be done is an MRI scan to rule out a brain tumor. So brain tumors, like I said, they present in different ways. Sometimes we just find them. Sometimes they present with headaches. Sometimes they present with weakness. Sometimes they present with personality change. Sometimes they present with, you know, motor weakness, difficulty walking, difficulty using their hand. There's many, many different presentations. And, you know, like I said, I mean, it's a nightmare of a diagnosis, you know, for some people, clearly. And it's very important to, you know, make the diagnosis as early as possible so that treatment options are available.
Okay, so along with those symptoms that you've mentioned, the seizures, the onsets of the headaches, and the MRI, that's pretty much how it's diagnosed?
Yes, exactly. That's sort of the gold standard. The MRI scan is the gold standard for making the diagnosis. And, you know, we sometimes use other tests as well, like a PET scan or a functional MRI scan. You know, a lot of different, you know, really higher tech stuff, but the first step is making the diagnosis. And the first step is sort of understanding, you know, what these, you know, you have to have somebody that's aware of that this may be a problem. You know, I've had patients, you know, over the years that, you know, tend to ignore symptoms. And for whatever reason, you know, a lot of these older people, you know, particularly like going to the doctor, you know.
Sure.
And then by the time they realize that they had, that just should have gone to the doctor, a lot of times the things are pretty far advanced. So it's important to stay sort of, you know, on top of your health, you know, as clearly you know, to make sure that things are more or less under control. Yeah, you know, you got to get to know your body very well, and all of a sudden your speech becomes, you know, unusual.
Slurred. Yeah.
Yeah. You need to realize that that's a real symptom. And you know, maybe you don't realize it, but you know, the family practice guys, the neurology guys, the other practitioners that are not necessarily in the neurological fields need to be fully aware that these are potential issues and potential, you know, potential indicators that there's a tumor.
So they're not misdiagnosed.
I mean, it's really a team approach. I mean, 100%. And you know, and the way these tumors are treated is also very much a team approach. You know, the neurosurgeons, then the neurology guys, are only one sort of cog in the whole system. You know, the other treatments generally involve radiation and chemotherapy. So a neuro-oncologist, a radiation oncologist, there's multiple people that are involved in the care of these patients.
Now, let me ask you this. What percentage of people in the age group do you normally see this in, or could just be any age group? I mean, do you see it more in the older people or opposed to pediatrics or just anything?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. We do see in the kids. They tend to, obviously, the tumors that we see in children tend to be different than we see in adults. But most commonly, the primary brain tumors that we see, you know, for the most part in the community, are in older people. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, probably in their, you know, 50s on up.
Okay.
And
so it's more of a higher.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yes, there are patients that are younger, but, you know, sort of the median age is like, you know, 50-ish, in the mid-50s. That's sort of like the standard. But like I said, there's also, you know, certain predilections for women versus men. It all depends. I mean, there's many different, it's important for you guys to realize, I mean, a brain tumor is not a brain tumor is not a brain tumor. Every patient is individual. Every situation is individualized, and people come in routinely with these pituitary adenomas. Like, you know, we see a lot of patients with different pathologies.
That's common, I hear.
It's not common, but you obviously hear about it. It's not, you know, one in a million thing. But like I said, it's important. You know, I've had patients who have had scans done, like, you know, earlier in the week, and they don't hear from their physician. I obviously don't know about them yet, but they make an appointment to come see me, and for the last week they've been like completely panicked, thinking that they're dying of a brain tumor. And when they come in, we look at the scan, and it's like, well, you know, you really have a benign cyst that's been coexisting with you forever. There's no real indication for doing any surgery. Let's just get a follow-up scan on you. So the panic that ensues when anybody hears that there's any type of a brain problem is insane. And obviously, but it's important to realize that not every situation is always a nightmare. There's good and bad. You know, there's situations that are much more tolerable and sometimes are not even necessarily treatable or necessary to be treated.
Mm. Now, is there any proof linked brain tumors to cell phones? Because I hear that a lot. Like, I see a lot of people don't want to talk on their cell phone or use the speaker phone or there's certain devices now. I mean, is that pretty much linked to it or we don't know?
No, I mean, there's not been any real data that has supported that.
Okay. Okay.
So the answer is no.
Okay. So the most common treatment for the primary tumor would be chemotherapy or radiation, right?
Well, it depends. Sometimes there's a whole system of recognizing it, then an MRI scan's done, diagnosing it, and then treating it. And that treatment can be multiple things. Obviously, the first step is to make a diagnosis. And by making a diagnosis, usually we need to get a piece of tissue. You know, we need to get something, either it needs to be removed or we need to do what's called a biopsy. And a biopsy just means that we're taking a piece of it out. So once a piece of this tumor or mass or whatever it is removed, the next step is to send that out to the appropriate lab to make a diagnosis as to exactly what the tumor type is. Then, even though it's a primary tumor, it could be, either a highly malignant tumor or a relatively benign tumor. So the treatment is going to depend solely on the diagnosis.
What kind of tumor,
Exactly. And not necessarily, not necessarily even the kind of tumor, but the grade of the tumor as well. So you could have a low-grade tumor that requires resection and then observation. You could have a tumor that requires, the whole gamut, including radiation and chemotherapy, depending on the malignancy of it. And, a highly malignant primary brain tumor is a very bad diagnosis. I mean, there's no really way around it. The treatment for that, yes, is radiation and chemotherapy, but, we've made certain strides over, the last few decades in terms of treatment, but it's still a very bad prognosis. And, most people with these.
So the chemo is really not that effective when it comes to somebody that has a malignant brain tumor. Is that what you're saying?
It's not as dramatic of a response as it is in certain other kinds of cancers. Clearly we give it because it has some effect. It slows things down, potentially, increases survival over the short term. But, I mean, you could be talking a matter of months in terms of extending survival instead of years or having a normal life.
Yeah.
So, I can't imagine, finding out, a much worse diagnosis than, a primary malignant brain tumor. There's a lot of research being done at multiple centers, all around the world. Memorial Sloan Kettering is a big center. Duke's a big center. Even our practice is doing some clinical trials. But, the fact that we haven't changed survival that much over the years shows that it's a really difficult diagnosis. And, basically what's going to happen over, the next whatever 50 years, they're going to find that the treatment of most of these kind of cancers is genetically based. And, right now that stuff is still, I wouldn't say in its infancy, but, we're far ways away from, curing brain cancer. No question about it.
It's a tough job, doctor. You really have a tough job.
You're right. I mean,
I'm sure you hear that a lot.
But let me tell you something. Let me tell you an important thing. That the most important part of being a good physician, whether it would be family practice, internal medicine, neurosurgery, is the ability to communicate with people, and the ability to communicate with people on their level, not necessarily speaking above them or speaking in doctor's terms and, confusing them. And that's something that I've always tried to do. I have a lot of friends that rely on me for different situations. I live in a community where, everybody knows I'm a doctor and, I'm more than happy to give advice all the time to all my friends. And I help a lot of people out. And you can't really teach that to somebody. Sometimes people don't really, when you go to see a doctor, it should be almost like you're going to see, you should be able to communicate with them without being intimidated.
Sure.
And, it's like I always tell my patients, if you go to a restaurant and you don't get the food that you like, you return it. And you basically complain and you get what you want. And it should be the same thing with your health. I mean, there's no good reason why, because I went to school for a little bit longer than you did, that I shouldn't be able to talk to you and make you comfortable in the things that we're discussing. So, that's a very, very important thing. You know, it's like, you know, people need to go in there with the understanding that, hey, listen, you know, even though you're a doctor and I'm not, you're working for me, buddy. You know, you work for me, and you know, if you don't like, it's a privilege for you to be taking care of a patient, not the other way around. You know, people should come to your office and be comfortable and be able to ask questions and not be intimidated. And if they're not, then if they can't do that, then they're not seeing the right doctor. So, you know, when people come to see me, you know, we have to give bad news, you know, certain times. I mean, there are times where, you know, we have to tell family members that, you know, their loved one is deceased. I mean, there are times when we go to the emergency room and we see these horrendous trauma things where people don't survive them. And you have a family member, you know, in the waiting room waiting to hear what's going on. And
so
you know, I have to be the one out there to tell them the bad news. So, you know, listen, somebody has to do it. And it's best to come from somebody that knows how to do it in a way that, you know, obviously it's never going to be, no one's going to ever be happy about that. But you got to walk in there and have some compassion and realize.
Sure, absolutely.
And you got to basically put everything that's going either good or bad in your life aside, because every single patient and every single family member has the same, you know, they have the same issues that you do. You know, you have kids, you have family, you do your own responsibilities, but we have an extra responsibility in that we're taking care of patients and people. And if you don't do that in the right way, I feel like you're failing. Like I've heard a million times where people will say, you know, he's a really good doctor, but his bedside manner sucks.
And
you know, then they're not a good doctor, because you know you got to be able to go in there and make people comfortable in whatever situation they're in, and sometimes it's not easy. But
no, I agree.
But to deliver news to people that is bad, they have to be told, and there's a way to tell them that, you know, it's very difficult to teach that. I mean, you know, I see it all the time where people come to see me and they're uncomfortable with their previous physician. They feel like they hadn't sat and showed them the imaging, or they haven't gone, or they haven't spent enough time with them. And yeah, it's difficult. You know, you know, we all have our issues, and we all have, you know, time crunches and schedules. But in the end, someone's coming to you and placing their health in your hands. And if you let them down, then you're not doing a very good job.
No, absolutely. No, that's a great approach. Well, okay. Let me ask you this. What about a stroke?
Stroke's a little bit different.
Okay.
Stroke is generally not necessarily treated by neurosurgeons.
Okay.
What a stroke is a stroke occurs when part of the brain is deprived of its oxygen supply. So, you know, in stroke, what happens is, you know, either, you know, for whatever reason, a part of the arterial system in the brain either gets a little clot in it where the blood can't pass through it.
So it's blocked, correct?
Exactly. So that's basically what a stroke is. Now, there could be different kinds of stroke, but there could be a stroke that is just what we call ischemic, which means that there's no bleeding. It's just basically a blockage of an artery. And you could imagine, I mean, if all of a sudden it's like being part of that brain is being choked off. It's not getting any oxygen. So when that part of the brain gets choked off, depending on which artery is involved, it causes significant deficit. And the most common deficit is, you know, weakness on one side, or what we call a hemiparesis or hemiplegia. So people can have, you know, a facial droop. They can have difficulty walking, difficulty using their hands. I mean, it's a very, you know, common problem that, you know, that is seen in the emergency room. Now, the treatment for stroke, depending on what kind. Sometimes there's people that have bleeding in the brain. Like, I was on call last night, got called into the emergency room. Someone had a big hemorrhage or a big bleed in the brain. That's a different kind of stroke. Sometimes those strokes can be surgically evacuated, but for the most part, the stroke that you're talking about that most people think of as a stroke is an area of the brain that just is not getting oxygen for whatever reason. And what happens is that if the stroke is bad enough, a big part of the brain doesn't get oxygen, and you could die from it. More commonly, you know, a portion of the brain is not getting oxygen, and it causes significant weakness, significant motor weakness or speech deficit. And a lot of times with therapy, those things will improve. Now, as a neurosurgeon, I don't generally get involved in those type of things. That's more of an ER visit, and then, you know, the neurologists get involved. Occasionally, they give different medications to break up the clot. clot called TPA. Sometimes okay. the interventional yeah. neurosurgeons, we have a couple of guys in our practice that do it. They can go in and sort of put a little thread, a little catheter all the way up into the, where the clot is and remove the clot. There's different things that can be done.
Right. But yeah, no, because I heard it's like the faster you get to the emergency room or something, the better the prognosis
100%.
Is. Yeah.
Exactly, because what happens is there's a certain window where if you can get there in a certain amount of time, then they can potentially give you drugs or medications to break up that clot and restore the function of the brain.
Right. And there's an acronym too, right? I believe for people, for family members or something, or it's called FAST, F-A-S-T or something, or to know when someone's having a stroke?
Exactly. And, right. and basically what it means, I mean, and that's another thing, is like, so it's important to be educated in a lot of different ways. You know, it's important for, you know, the community to be educated, you know, so that they can save, you know, it's almost like, what's happening with stroke, and it's been happening for a number of years now, they're treating it just like a heart attack. And they talk about it as a brain attack. So with a heart attack, you know, if you can restore blood flow and, you know, you can save the tissue of the heart to make it function normally again, then people survive. Same thing with the brain. If you can get that clot broken up quickly with those medications I discussed, then the brain function gets restored and people can return to normal. But right. if that doesn't happen, or if too much time passes by, the brain tissue dies, and only right. certain, you know, your recovery is certainly going to be limited by the fact that you can't get the blood flow restored quickly enough.
Sure, yeah, it cuts off. Okay, well, let me ask you this. Aside from the brain tumors, what are the other common issues patients come and seek you?
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, there's definitely okay. a few different things. So like I said, in the community, most people come with spine issues. So before okay. we head over to the spine section, so in the brain, there's multiple different things. Like, yeah, and it's interesting, you know, most people aren't really aware. I mean, as a neurosurgeon, there's many different subspecialties within neurosurgery. It's not, you know, somebody would say, oh, well, you're a neurosurgeon. You know, that's sort of like the, you know, you're very highly specialized in what you do. The reality is that, yes, we're specialized compared to like a family practice person or a general internist, but in the end, there are certain things that I don't do and certain things that my partners do that, you know, that there's a lot of subspecializing within neurosurgery. There are certain specialties that deal with the vascular problems, which are like arteries and veins. So there's a subspecialty of vascular. One of my partners does, if you've ever seen on TV or heard about the treatment for Parkinson's. There's okay. a treatment called deep brain stimulation where you can put an electrode into a certain part of the brain, stimulate it, and basically stop the tremors that occur from Parkinson's. He also does a lot of, you know, pain procedures where someone comes in with pain in different parts of their body, and there can be different implants. Like you had spoken to Lori Tankleff. Lori Tankleff had a spinal cord stimulator. So that's another subsection of neurosurgery. But in the brain itself, so there's vascular things. There can be, you can have an aneurysm, you can have a brain tumor, you can have brain trauma, you know, from a car accident. There's many different things that are subspecialties within the brain. And that's a whole subcategory. And then the other very big category is the spine stuff. And,
okay.
and you can imagine that the reason that the spine stuff is so popular is because there are many, many more people that complain of back pain, sciatica,
sure.
neck problems. I mean, it's much more common in the community than, you know, a quote-unquote brain problem. And you could imagine, I mean, you know, Long Island is, you know, we have a, you know, for the amount of space that's in Long Island, we have a significantly, you know, we have a large number of neurosurgeons that are here. And, you know, it's not like you can pick and choose whatever specialty you want to do. If you want to be a community-based neurosurgeon, the thing that you're going to see most commonly is spine stuff. No question okay. about it. And by spine, I mean neck, which is, you know, the cervical. You know, the spine is broken up into multiple areas. So
sure.
the cervical spine is in the neck. The lumbar spine is in the low back. So generally speaking, the most common things that we see in private practice are related to neck and, you know, neck stuff and lower back stuff. Those are the two most common things that we see.
So you see a lot of herniated discs?
Well, yes, we see, you know, it's important to realize that these things are, like the same way that we talked about the brain stuff. People have to be aware of, you know, when should they go to the doctor for this? You know, you could, you know, lean over and twist a certain way and, you know, quote unquote, pull your back out. You know, does that require a trip to your neurosurgeon? You know, obviously not. But the people that have, you know, long-standing or not even such long-standing, like say, you know, you go to pick something up and all of a sudden you feel like a pop in your back. And, you know, usually the common story is that people have initially some back pain and some spasm, and then the pain sort of centers in their leg. And the reason that that occurs is because the nerves that are in the lower back sort of come off the spine from there. They travel down into the leg, and if they're irritated at the level of the spine, they usually cause problems with your legs. So, you know, that's what sciatica is. Sciatica is a generic term that essentially means you're having pain or, you know, motor weakness in your leg related to a lumbar problem. So, you know, when somebody comes in the office, and their most common complaint is, you know, wow, you know, my back hurts and I have this crazy pain going down my leg. I've had it for, you know, a couple of months. I already went to pain management. I already had injections. So generally speaking, they have an MRI scan, and that MRI scan will show something where a nerve in their lower back is most likely being irritated or compressed by something.
What causes it, the sciatic?
Well, like I said, sciatic nerve is a nerve that is made up of multiple different nerves. It's sort of a amalgamation of nerves from the lumbar spine. Like multiple nerve roots come together and they form the sciatic nerve. So when people say that they have sciatica, that's basically a generic term. It's a generic term saying that I have, you know, leg pain from a back problem. Now, what causes sciatica?
Mm-hmm.
An irritation or compression of a nerve in your low back generally causes that. So
could it be done from exercise or just age? Or
that's a good question. Like, say, let's say you're working out like crazy. All of a sudden, you like I said, you feel this crazy pop. All of a sudden, and then your pain sort of settles in your leg. There's a good chance that you have what's called a disc herniation.
I mean, so if you hear something like when you're doing an activity and there's a pop,
I'm using that as an example, but most commonly, people that have disc herniations, they have no idea how they got them. Most patients that come to see me, they'll come in the office, and you know they will already have seen multiple other doctors because you know, sometimes they'll their general practice doctor will see them. They're not, you know, they're not rushing them over to see a neurosurgeon because, you know, they think that, you know, one of the things when you go see a surgeon is you think that every surgeon just wants to operate on you because that's really what we do for a living. But reality is that if you have a good surgeon and your surgeon works with a network of people, ideally the best interest of you is what's in our minds. Like, just because you have a disc herniation does not mean that you need surgery. We're going to basically make sure that we've exhausted all the non-surgical options before we recommend surgery. So like I said, most people that come to see me have no idea why it happened. They'll come in the office, they fill out their paperwork, they come in to see me and I go, what happened? And they said, I don't really know. Like, 3 months ago, I noticed my back was starting to hurt, and then the back pain sort of went away, and now I have pain going down my leg. And an MRI scan's done. It shows that there's a disc herniation. And what a disc herniation generally, you know, when I try to explain it to patients on their terms, it's like a jelly donut. So you can imagine, everyone knows what a jelly donut is.
Yeah.
So if you have a jelly donut in between two bones, if you could imagine that the dough part of the donut gets a little defect in it or it breaks open, the jelly part can squirt out. The jelly part squirts out. It generally squirts out to one side, either to the right side or to the left side. If it squirts out towards the left side, you get pain going down your left leg, and vice versa to the right side. So a lot of patients have disc herniations. At least, you know, they have disc bulges or herniations based on the scans. But so there's a very large number of patients walking around with abnormal MRI scans that show disc bulges or disc herniations that don't necessarily have symptoms. So just because your MRI scan shows an abnormality does not lock you into having an operation. So my general you know, treatment regimen. If someone comes, if I'm the first line, you know, generally speaking, if I'm the first, you know, neurologic person to see the patient,
okay,
I'll send them for other treatments. I'll generally send them for physical therapy. Many times we'll send patients to pain management. We have a very good group of people that we work with routinely, and I trust them. Like, you know, things have changed so much over the years in terms of communication. That's the key. I mean, communication within the healthcare professionals has always been a problem, even to the point where it's like, you know, everybody says, well, how come you don't know what this guy's doing? How come this guy doesn't know what you're doing? Because the communication has not been so easy. Generally go, you pick up the phone, you send an email. You send a text. And that way, like, we have patients that come into my office, and if they come in with sciatic pain or, you know, this ridiculous pain that's going down their leg, and they haven't had any other treatment, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to, you know, make a phone call to one of my colleagues and say, hey, do me a favor. Can you see this guy? Can you get him in today? He's in a lot of pain. And it helps people immensely, doctor-to-doctor communication, rather than, okay, well, here's a card. Give this guy a call. And then they make an appointment, and it's 2 weeks later, and they're suffering for another 2 weeks, and they just waste time and waste time and waste time. And the reality is that we can expedite things so much better just by communicating with each other. It's just a tremendous benefit.
Okay, but so that's one of the key things to look for as a patient, is make sure the doctors are all on the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing. I mean, listen, right. Everybody has their sort of, like, you know, the things that they do well in life. And, you know, it goes, you know, just be, like I said before, I mean, just because I'm a doctor doesn't mean that, you know, I should treat you differently than your plumber, your air conditioning guy. I mean, you want service, and the service should be provided by your healthcare professional. Yes, it's a little different because it's your health, but you would argue that it's even more important. You know, like, okay, your air conditioner breaks, you get it fixed. If you break, it's not so easy to fix it a lot of times. But you want to make sure that there's a network of people that is basically on your side. I mean, I can't even tell you the number of people that come in here that say, listen, I went to see this guy. I can't even believe how much different, you know, it is coming to see you, because you sit and you talk to me, you explain me these films. You know, this guy, like, you know, threw me out of the office.
No, that's important. That's absolutely important, yeah.
I mean,
when I go visit my doctor, he sits down and tells me about his life. I love it.
Yeah, it's important to have that relationship with people that you can, you know, you get to know them. And, you know, it's unusual where I would, you know, the person walks in the door the first day and I'm like, okay, you need surgery. Sometimes, especially with the spine problems are not, you got to realize that the thing in the spine is very different than almost any other thing. You know, most people there's not one person that you know that never had any kind of back pain or any kind of issue like that. So because you have back pain, or because you have sciatica, or because you have neck pain, or because you have arm pain, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need surgery.
So what is the alternate treatment then for sciatica if you don't need surgery? Is it exercise? Is it maybe a cortisone shot? I mean, what exactly? Let's say you don't need surgery. What would you do?
Well, it depends. The first thing is you have to, you know, communicate with your patient. You got to discuss it with them. You know, what are your symptoms? How bad are your symptoms? Some people, no matter how bad, they don't understand. Like, they don't have the perspective that that we have. So if someone comes in with, you know, a very common problem, to them, it could be, you know, a life-altering thing in terms of how their pain is. But then when you explain to them what kind of surgery potentially we're going to offer you, all of a sudden they're like, well, I don't want to have any surgery. So even though they think that they want it, they don't want to undergo a big giant procedure, because when you, after talking to them, they realize that they're not really as bad as they thought they were. And there's other things that they're treated with. Like I said, physical therapy, injections, those quote unquote cortisone injections you talked about, those are called epidural steroid injections. Sometimes, if you have an injury where, you know, all of a sudden you hurt your back and you have leg pain, you know, without surgery, there's a very large percentage of patients that will get better on their own. So it's the ones that don't get better on their own that we sit and we talk to them. And I say, listen, this is what we can offer you. These are the things that are potentially able to fix your problem. This is the risk of the surgery. This is the benefits of the surgery.
Okay. So,
and if it's a small procedure with a tremendous amount of benefit and a limited amount of risk, obviously that's the way to go once you've exhausted all your other things. However, there are people that have back pain. people that have, you know, back pain itself, you know, back pain by itself is a tremendously common problem. I mean, chiropractors, inversion tables, and acupuncture.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million things that people do for back pain. The surgical treatment of back pain is a difficult problem. Once you're talking about back pain alone or back pain associated with leg pain, the treatment for that, usually if it's going to be surgical, requires a different operation than it would for like a disc herniation or something smaller. So
what's the recovery time on that?
It depends. It depends on what the surgery is. There are patients that we operate, you know, for like I did two cases on Friday. Those patients both went home on Saturday. They're both disc herniation problems. One had a disc herniation in their neck. One had a disc herniation in their back. Both of those patients were in and out of the OR within a couple hours. They basically stayed, you know, stay overnight, and the next morning they're gone. The recovery for those patients is a couple of weeks, two to 4 weeks, depending on what their job is. Some people go back to work in 2 weeks. Some people go back to work in 4 weeks. I mean, if you're, you know, an iron worker, it's a different job than someone that sits behind a desk every day. So every situation is different. Now, if you're talking about a bigger operation where people would require, you know, a fusion with the instrumentation, that's a little bit bigger operation. And that requires a longer recovery and a whole different discussion with the patient in terms of how they're managed. So what I say to everybody, it's like, you know, you're gonna know when you're ready for surgery. I'm gonna explain to you, we're gonna get to know each other, and I'm gonna explain to you what the appropriate what I can offer you and what things are available outside of neurosurgery to treat your problem. But in the end, you know, if you realize that you're going to have a surgery that, you know, yes, it may help you, but there's also a possibility that it may not help you that much, or that it might help you a little bit, but not completely get back to normal. You think about it. You have a 65-year-old guy that has degenerative spine disease and, you know, pain in their back and pain in their legs. You know, we're going to try and help them with surgery, but they have to understand that, you know, 65 years of, you know, wear and tear on your spine is not necessarily fixable doing a big fusion operation. So it could help them significantly, you know, in the short term. Sometimes they make, you know, night and day recoveries, but there's a lot of patients that recover, but they're not as good as they want to be. And it's my responsibility to make them understand what they can expect, what things, you know, what is the best outcome and what is the worst outcome. And then ultimately it's going to be the patient's decision as to what they want to do. Do they want to, you know, are they bad enough? Are they in a bad enough situation where...
Right. Pros outweighs the cons, yeah.
Right, 100%. I mean, everything in life is risk versus benefit. You know, when you're doing a disc herniation operation that takes 2 hours or an hour and a half, the person wakes up and they're like miraculously cured where their leg pain is completely gone. That's a different operation than someone that requiring a big fusion. But it's all part of our skill set. You know, that we can offer certain things for certain problems. But the most important part of it is communication. You know, it's not like someone comes in the office and we say to them, wow, you know, your spine problem is, you know, it's going to kill you. It's usually an annoying, uncomfortable situation, and they come to see me because of that. So if you can live with being a little bit uncomfortable, sometimes that's okay in comparison to having a big fusion operation or an operation where you don't want to take the risk. So.
Right.
It's all give and take in terms of how you talk to your patients and making them understand the risks and benefits.
Now, what about this? What about scoliosis, the curvature of the spine?
Scoliosis.
Do you see that a lot, or?
Well, I mean, it's a common problem, but I don't really treat that. Scoliosis is treated by, you know, one of my partners in my practice works, you know, does that pretty frequently. But like I said, I mean, every neurosurgeon has their own specialties. That's not one of mine.
So, what's your specialty? Tell me another specialty of yours.
I would say that, you know, I enjoy operating on the brain, but the most common thing that I see in my practice is this, you know, minimally invasive spine stuff where, you know, someone comes in with these problems that I talked about, you know, back pain, leg pain, neck pain, arm pain. So doing, you know, microsurgery, you know, using an operative microscope, and making a significant difference in these people's lives is my specialty. I mean, doing minimally invasive spine and the ability to, you know, relieve pressure on a nerve and therefore, you know, making people's quality of life better. That's sort of the main thing that I do now. You know, earlier in my practice, you know, I worked at a major trauma hospital, so a lot of what I did was major trauma. You know, we would see
car accidents and stuff like that.
Yeah, car accidents, fall, falls from a height, slip and falls on the ice, especially living here in the wintertime. A lot of different a lot of different things related to trauma. But once you sort of shift your practice and you work in a place where you don't see as much trauma anymore, it's more, what I do is like most other doctors. I have, office hours. People come to see me. They come in with their imaging studies. They get sent in from their physicians, referred in to see me. And, we sit, we talk, I examine them. We basically make a decision as to, can I help you? Can I help you with surgery? Can I help you by sending you to another set of physicians that we use? Can I help you by sending you to physical therapy, by sending you to a chiropractor? But it's the, not necessarily the ability to operate on somebody. It's the judgment in terms of who should get surgery and who shouldn't that makes a surgeon a good surgeon versus a bad surgeon. Obviously, you want somebody that is able to, operate well and technically is excellent. But you can teach that. You can teach, you can teach someone to be, it's like an automated thing. You do certain things over and over, you become good at it. But you can't teach somebody to, to think, to have judgment.
Right.
And that's exactly what the better physicians are able to do.
Right. Now, are there any future techniques coming up with any of these less invasive procedures?
Always.
Okay. Can you give us some examples or something that you think that might, the listeners may want to hear? Or?
Well, basically let's talk about the standard patient that will come in, okay?
Okay.
So someone comes in, 60-year-old person, back pain, leg pain for a number of years, sort of suffering through it.
Okay.
Eventually, goes to the doctor because they can't take it anymore. They get sent to their pain management physician. The pain management guy sort of gives them an injection or a series of injections. Over that period of time, they just realize that, hey, this is not really working for me. I'm wasting a lot of time. The injections are not being as effective as they used to be. They'll come in with an MRI scan, and I'll evaluate that scan and the patient. And I'll look at the scan, and I'll say to them, okay, these are your options. Because you have back pain, because you have a lot of degenerative disease, my recommendation from a surgical standpoint is going to be a lumbar fusion. And a lumbar fusion, like I said, generally is a bigger operation than doing a disc surgery or, a neck surgery for a disc. And it's going to require a higher degree of, technical expertise.
Okay.
In terms of, it's a longer operation. It requires some different instrumentation that is delivered by, different companies that make this equipment. And what's happening is that equipment is becoming better and better and better. And the techniques to put things in. Sometimes we can do things, like I said, I alluded to minimally invasive.
Right.
When we do operations, a lot of times, when we're doing these big surgeries, we'll make sometimes a 6-7 inch incision in just to get access to do the operation and put the appropriate instrumentation in.
Right. Now,
it's different. What's happening over time is that there are techniques that are being developed that allow us to do things through smaller openings that require less blood loss, that are faster recovery times.
Oh,
and
great.
The technology is improving, dramatically. If you're a technically good surgeon and you do these operations, they're just little tweaks on things that we already know how to do. So hopefully, most people when they think of neurosurgery, they think of the brain and they think of the brain only. I mean, I have a lot of friends that, I socialize with routinely who, after all these years didn't even realize that I do spine. They think that most of the stuff is really brain. They think it's, when they think of neurosurgery, I think of brain surgery and only brain surgery.
Right.
But the reality is, like I said, I mean, a lot of people in the community have these, have spine problems. I mean, it's just so common. Everybody has I've seen, 30 people just in my community alone that have come to see me with different issues. And, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to look at each patient as an individual and not look at the scan and the scan only and say, okay, well, your scan looks like this, then we have to do this operation. There are people that I've seen that have been recommended surgeries where, yes, the scan justifies it, but the symptoms don't necessarily justify it. So, like I said, I mean, it's not, you don't have cancer and you're not going to die from this problem. It's annoying, it's uncomfortable, but it's not a life-threatening problem. So
right.
if you can live with it and it's not so bad, you know, you shouldn't be scared into having an operation because of what your scan looks like. So it's,
right.
it's really a multiple-pronged approach. You know, it's like...
So you kind of treat the symptoms more. Is that what you're saying?
The symptoms are the key thing. You know,
like how much pain are you in from a scale from 1 to 10? And
right.
if they're not in so much pain, but the
if you're able to work out every day, go to work every day and do your activities of daily living, you know...
There's no need for an operation.
Exactly. And there's no need for anything. But then there are people that are, you know, a 9 out of 10 every day that are out of work, that are not walking normally anymore, that limp into the office with a walker.
Quality of life for them is a little
And those patients are, you know, jumping to have surgery. They're like, you know, and they generally have been through the mill and have failed multiple things. And, the neurosurgical side of things, you know, when I lecture routinely and I always tell the primary care physicians, the neurology guys, all these people the same thing. I said, you know, we're a team. You know, I'm not looking to take your patient away from you and operate on them and do something that's ridiculous. If we are able to communicate better and we work as a team, we'll work together. You know, you call me up, you say, hey, I got this patient. You know, this is what I think is going on. What do you think? They'll come in.
Yeah.
I'll look at the films and I'll say to them, yeah, you know what? I agree. I think they're potentially
That's an excellent approach. Absolutely.
They're potentially a candidate for surgery, but it's not necessarily that they are. You know, let's see. You know, let's see what happens. If I could send you to a pain management doctor, they give you one, you know, epidural steroid injection, your leg pain goes away. Unless your skin looks absolutely horrible, I'm happy. You know, I mean, yes, would I like to operate on you? Sure. But there's enough other patients in the world that we can find that actually are, you know, solid candidates more than manufacturing candidates. And I think a lot of people feel that neurosurgeons and surgeons in general are, you know, cut happy and everybody wants to operate. The reality
right.
is that if you're good at what you do, that's not your primary goal is to help patients. And if you can
right.
help them by sending them to somewhere else first, and they realize that they failed
right.
at management, they're going to come back to see you because they realize you're a good guy and you're doing the right thing by them. And that's how you have to go through life.
Now, doctor, I hate to cut you short, but we have a few more minutes. I told you, time flies.
Okay.
Now, would you care to leave some of your information with the listeners? So if they need to contact you or maybe send you an email or something?
Sure. No, absolutely.
Okay.
I'll give my, like I said, I work for a company called Neurological Surgery PC.
Okay.
You can be found on the web at nspc.com. Multiple physicians in my practice, our bios are up there. There's different, you know, some videos and things. I think there's actually a video up of me. I think that even this podcast will probably be linked to, as well.
Okay.
The office number, I work primarily, out in West Islip. That's our main office. That's where I am today. The office number here is, 631-983-8400. You can reach me, also via email at, D as in dog, and my last name, K-R-I-E-F-F, at nspc.com. And obviously, we welcome, you know, any of your listeners to get in touch with us. And
great.
We're happy to help. No question.
Great. And thank you, doctor. And before we come to a closing, I would like to thank you so much for coming down here today and taking, I know that you're very busy and sharing your expertise in this field. I think our listeners got a lot out of, you know, certain symptoms, treatments, and different alternatives and how it all works. Thank you.
No problem.
And
happy to help.
Yeah, thank you very much, doctor. Thank you. And once again, listeners, you're listening to The Best of Health and Fitness, and I am your host, Shani Rubin. And if anyone has any guest ideas or suggestions or any questions, you know, you guys can always contact me or email me at shanirubin14@gmail.com. Enjoy your rest of the week. Doctor, thank you.